Hello and welcome to another Cynical Supplement. We didn't record an episode this week, mostly because in that post E3 glow, essentially everyone's just busy doing other things, not focusing on game. You know, after a week of like barely focusing your family or your job or whatever, you kind of need to have that moment to, reflect, get back to how things work in the real world outside of like the Christmas period of E3. The last 2 weeks we haven't recorded on the normal time on Saturday. Oh, my phone going off. I don't know what that is. Anyway, I am a crazy person. So I thought, fuck it, I may as well record something this week just for people, hanging around. I have nothing to listen to, whatever. I also have like a bunch of things a particular big game I've been playing, which is the episode title might have given away, that I want to talk about a lot. Before I get into Zelda, which we'll talk about at the end of the show, and for that, by the way, I'll be talking first non-spoilery and then spoilery, so for people who are worried about Zelda spoilers, I'm only going to be doing that at the very end of the show. But first, before we get there, I'm just going to talk about a little bit of news here, just my opinions on the recent news, and thankfully there isn't much, because I don't have too much time to record now, but the only two real big pieces of news, honestly, from my perspective, and I might be missing something, but I don't think so, is that the Xbox One X international prices are out, and Nintendo Classic SNES, or SNES Classic, Super Nintendo Classic Edition, has been announced to replace the NES Classic, or Mini, as people call it, from last year. And those are the essentially like almost polar opposite products. We're talking about like the high-end Xbox One X and the entry level slash like almost casual, for many people, although I doubt the casuals even get a chance to buy it, considering how many hardcore people actually want the SNES Classic. Little like cheap little console to take home. So first I'm going to talk about the Xbox One X. Primarily because the international pricing is interesting. What we find out is that the pricing is actually determined by region. And what that means is some people are getting a great deal and some people are getting absolutely shafted. So specifically, let's have a look here. I've got a GameSpot article up and a ValueWalk.com, I haven't heard of them before, article up. And it's fun because they did the conversions for you. So in the United States, obviously, it's $499 US dollars for the Xbox One X. However, regional pricing, be what it is, it's only $599 Canadian dollars, which means it's actually like $450 US in Canada. And that's an awesome price for that thing. Especially like since Canadians and Australians get shafted. Speaking of Australia, it comes across as, let's see, it's $649 Australian dollars, and that goes to $649 AUD to USD, $493 US dollars. But that's with tax. So if you take another 10% off that, we're looking at like $450 or so US dollars, which is actually incredibly reasonable compared to what we usually get as Australians. My thoughts about the Xbox One X, like potentially partially aside. However, people in the Europe and UK, they're getting absolutely wrecked because we're looking at £449 in Britain, which is $570 US dollars. God, I don't know how much of that is VAT, considering how cheap it is in Australia and Canada. They have to be raking something in there. And then for euro, it's $499 euro as well. And that works out at roughly 569 or so US dollars as well, at the time of this recording. And that's just kind of sad. So like if you like rewind to my thoughts about the Xbox One X, honestly, if you're in Europe or Britain, there's like, I can double down on my thoughts about do not buy that thing, just upgrade your PC. Or like the only people who should buy that thing are people who definitely never want a gaming PC, who like definitely only really want a place to play multi-platform games and some Xbox exclusives. And the best place to play that is going to be the Xbox One. And for $570, I guess you're saving something there, but you can build like a pretty good, Like, if you're up for it, you can definitely build a really good game PC for like $550 equivalent, especially if you go used parts. So many people, so easy to get like really good used parts, ultra cheap. Like, for example, a 980 Ti in Australia is going for $400, and in the US you can get from like $220 or $250. Like, that thing performs, if you overclock it, as well as a 1080. To be fair, like 980 Ti overclocked versus 1080 not overclocked, but still, you're really getting a massive bang for the buck there if you go for used parts. It's so easy to find used parts. So many people are selling and upgrading and so on. But yes, if you really do want to stick to new, then yeah, especially if you look at the $570 price point, you are definitely looking at Xbox One X for multi-platform games. However, for Canada and Australia, that $50 difference is actually significant. Like, that puts it under the cost of a 1070, and that's very interesting because, especially with console level optimization, you're looking at very comparable, if not better, performance in the Xbox One X for less. That's a whole system. Wow. Like, to be fair, again, a computer can be used for more, and with Xbox, all the games are coming to PC as well. So of the two, I would still recommend getting a PC or getting a 1070. Just upgrading to an Xbox 1070 if you have a PC capable of it. But if you are looking for a place to game and you do not want a gaming PC, then Xbox One X for Canada and Australia, that actually seems like a really good deal. For US, it's kind of in between, being that $499 price point. And that's pretty much what I have to say about that. It's very interesting to me that they went for localized pricing, especially looking at those European and UK pricing points. I just don't know what they're doing there. It's just crazy to me. With that, though, I'm going to quickly move on to the Nintendo SNES Classic Edition. That thing is exactly what we expected it would be. The crazy thing to me is just they seem to have picked the really good games. People seem to be really excited about Star Fox 2 for some reason. As a person who has no idea what the hell Star Fox is about, I don't know why people are excited about Star Fox 2. Maybe we can bring it up with Dura next time we record. But I looked at that list and was surprised there was only like one really good big JRPG on there. Like, we're talking about just Final Fantasy 3, which is translated to Final Fantasy 6 in the US and Australia. So the probably most agreed upon best Final Fantasy in the hardcore community, ? Lots of people like Final Fantasy 7, obviously. Lots of people like Final Fantasy 8 and 10. Not many people argue for 12, and almost no one argues for 13. But 6 seems to be the one a lot of people can rally behind. The type of people who love 9 tend to love 6, and that's a lot of people. And apparently that's one of the best stories. I didn't like that old school art design, the weird, like, I just don't know what to call it. It's just a very almost Japanese painterly art style. I hated it. I've always hated it, but whatever. That's a very small thing considering that's like a SNES pixel art game. But no, I, as a person who has owned 3 copies of Final Fantasy VI and played none of them, it's interesting that that's the only really big JRPG that's on the SNES Classic. I was expecting to see at least a Chrono Trigger. And from memory, Final Fantasy IV, let me have a look. Final Fantasy IV SNES, I swear it was. Final Fantasy IV. I swear that was. Let's have a look here. Come on, Google. Stop being a piece of shit. Let's see. SNES, yes. So it was a Super NES game. And that's probably one of my favorite, personally, my favorite Final Fantasies. Cecil, etc. That was a great one. They went to the moon. On the space whale, I think. That's that one, right? I'm pretty sure that's that one. Fucking, I might be crazy here. But anyway, that was my main reaction. As a person who doesn't give a shit about Mario, as has been said multiple times in the past, I am happy they included probably the best Mario on there. I would say Super Mario World. So most people would be pretty happy with that. We could have maybe hoped for All-Stars, which I think includes World. I'm not an expert. But, you know, they picked the good one. But aside from that, it's kind of the list you expect, which is, to many people, exactly what they want. So that thing's already sold out in the US. I don't know about here. It's going to sell out, and I have no idea if Nintendo will even intends to keep up with demand for this one. What we do know, though, is that the controller cables are now 2 feet longer than the previous one, so maybe slightly less overly short, but still a little bit short. That's my takeaway there. So for people who want that, sorry, it's already sold out, but for everyone else, who just likes watching from the sidelines like I do, it's an interesting thing. This is an interesting thing that happened. Hey. So that's two pieces of news. And with that, essentially I'm going to move on for the rest of the show to Zelda talk. As stated, I finished that game finally. I'd guess around 45 hours in. And so this first half, I'm going to be talking about just the gameplay of Zelda. My thoughts upon that. Overarching non-spoilery thoughts on the storyline and the method of delivery and the world building. And then I'm going to hit into spoiler talk at the very end. Considering how little story is in that game, it's not going to be much spoiler talk, but there you go. First of all, I want to preface this with, I did not fall in love with Zelda. I did not hate Zelda. So for people who are like wondering like what kind of perspective I'm going to have on it and might want to tune out if they don't want to hear me like criticizing parts of that game, I guess this is your time to tune out. If you're interested in hearing like just like a critical analysis or my personal critical analysis of Zelda, then stick around because that's what this is going to be. To front load this with for your expectations here for you at home, I would probably give Zelda like an 8 out of 10. It's a solid 8. It's a good-ass video game. It is not like top echelons. For me personally, I don't see why or how it even got that kind of acclaim. But you know what? Maybe to a specific type of person of which I can postulate, it would be an almost perfect game for. So maybe that's why. Maybe people in the gaming press are just the type of person who this game is really geared towards. And I'll go into more of that in a bit. Let's talk about gameplay. Again, to set people at home's expectations and to give you a perspective on me and my playthrough of Zelda, again, I took around, if I was to guess, 40 or so hours. I finished all the dungeons. I got every tower. I saw with my eyeballs every part of the map. I got 54-ish shrines, 40 Korok seeds, because I just stopped doing them after a while, 3 of the 4 fairy fountains, because I just couldn't afford the last one for 10,000 rupees, or whatever they call it. And I beat Ganon, obviously, and I beat the game. Oh yeah, sorry, I also got every memory in the game, that was good. I got the Master Sword, I got the my armor upgraded to the third tier for some of it, I think second tier for other parts of it. I got the shield, the Hylian shield as well. So I did a pretty decent like all-round playthrough of it. I didn't do a completionist playthrough. I didn't get 120 shrines or whatever. But I did play quite a lot of that game. And it did keep me around for a lot of it. And that's impressive to some extent, considering at some point I got sort of fatigued with it and rushed towards the end. But it still did keep me for a while after that. So with that perspective, I'm going to just delve into the gameplay. And I'm going to split it up into a couple different points. And I'm trying to go, let's see if I can make it go positive, negative, and do it like a shit sandwich kind of approach to it. So, positive. I really like their twist on the open world genre. I don't know if it will work for every type of game or every open world game, but it is a very interesting approach. And I think a midpoint between the Ubisoft formula and this formula is probably where I'd like to see all open world games going. To elaborate on that, I would say that the fundamental redesign that Nintendo did was to make two changes to the Ubisoft open world formula. The Ubisoft open world formula being like you have towers where you get to tower, you scan an area, and you suddenly get on your map revealed everything you can do in that area, and then you can like tick it off like a checklist. And a lot of people find that fatiguing because it doesn't do a great job of surfacing the interesting stuff from the not interesting stuff. And it also just makes it so that you can get into like a really boring grind, a churn of going from thing to thing to thing, checking things off your map. Horizon does it to a very much lesser extent. Witcher does it with the notice boards you can go to that reveals like question marks on your map. And obviously like every Ubisoft game, quintessentially Assassin's Creed does it. And it can get very fatiguing. And so what Nintendo did was in this one, they, as you may know, don't do that. When you get, they had towers in this game, but when you get to a tower, what you do is essentially just a vantage point. You don't have to go to towers this game to have any of the advantages of having a tower aside from fast travel. When you get to the top of a tower, things in the environment stand out in a way where you can pick off from a distance using the binoculars or the Sheik's Slate or whatever you want to call it, what in the distance is interesting and what you want to do. And so you can mark for yourself by populating on the map by yourself what you're interested in and do just that. And that's cool. It's a user-driven method of discovery which tweaked a lot of people the right way. People, I guess, like being lost in a world and not necessarily having things just fed to them. So if you're that type of person who just doesn't like those checklists, I can see why this is a great innovation. To me, though, I wouldn't necessarily go 100% that direction, and I wasn't necessarily 100% happy with it. The reason why is, though I liked the ability to be at high points and discover things that way for myself, what I also found was that because everything had to be visible from a distance and therefore distinguishable as an interesting or a point of interest from a distance, so you can mark them from towers, etc., things started looking very samey. So there is only really like two kinds of shrine, or maybe three. There's the obvious one that you can see from a million miles away. There's the flat one, which is like, it just looks like a circle on the ground that you have to activate in a special way. And then I think in some cases, there are ones that are just straight up hidden that you can't see. There's essentially three types of shrine. Additionally, as I've said many times in the past, there's only a couple different kinds of Korok puzzles that I saw in that game. And they're all very obvious for a reason, obviously. So they are there to serve a purpose, as in having something to do between things as you ride through the countryside. So you should be able to see it from a distance. But because you can see it from distance, they make it obvious. So they generally try to make it obvious. And in doing so, it means that everything just kind of looks the same. Like I'm looking for that rock in the center of an almost complete circle of rocks. Or three trees that look the same, which is my classic example. Or a suspicious single tree in the middle of nowhere. And you kind of just look at that and go, okay, I know exactly what's going to happen over there. With the shrines, like, okay, there's just those three kinds of shrines, and I know what I'm looking at already. Especially with like the fact that most shrines are the same, that none of them are particularly the same in that the puzzle is the same, but they're all the same length and depth of experience within variability. Like there's obviously some that are simpler than others, and there's some that are awesome, like the to the south and the mazes, which I did after Durin's recommendation. I wouldn't call them awesome, but they're good compared to normal shrines. But in general, like you know what you're looking at already just by seeing something. So the fact that everything's noticeable from a distance, and essentially the world is so large they had to populate it very like almost they replicated the same content many times in that world, that really detracted from it for me. Additionally, you can't surface through that method, as in visible from a distance. You can't surface interesting quests. Like sometimes it is visible in that you can see a trail of smoke in the distance, and so you can go towards that and usually meet an NPC and have fun with a somewhat interesting quest. But lots of the best quests in this game are in towns or random NPCs kind of in the middle of nowhere that you have to kind of stumble across. And to some extent, that's great, because the feeling of stumbling across one of those random NPCs, I still remember like the first time you hear the accordion sound in the distance and you go towards that bard, and that was awesome. That is awesome in general, like the stumbling across NPCs, but I feel like the best content in this game are those NPCs and quests. And because they're so hard to find in many cases, I didn't do many of them, like at all. I barely did any of them. I didn't even know that the bard had a quest line. That's crazy to me that apparently that quest line, which is one of the best in the game, I just didn't even know about or do. So I guess it rewards people who have like really love user-driven exploration. But if you compare that to Witcher, where just looking at a notice board, you can tell whether something's interesting or not, because it tells you what the quest will be. And you can take the ones you want and leave the ones you don't want. And then the ones you want tend to be warm and deep and interesting. And it's like a kind of a dual purpose of you find them by finding a notice board and then choosing the ones you want. And then it leads you to, by marking on your map, something really interesting. I think that's a better way of doing it. A lot of people will find that really annoying for me to say, but I think for quests, that is a better way of doing it. Because you find the interesting stuff. Most people go through Witcher and most people who like put a lot of time into Witcher see most of the same things, and most of those same things are excellent. Same with Skyrim to another extent. Like, that thing marks a lot of stuff in your map, obviously, but a lot of that stuff is in fact excellent, and most people who play that game do get a chance to see a lot of, if not all of it. Definitely not all of it, but a lot of it. So everyone knows there's a Mage's Guild, and that's pretty good. Everyone knows there's a Thieves Guild, and that's pretty good. Everyone knows there's a equivalent to the Dark Brotherhood. Well, there is the Dark Brotherhood, and that's all right. So like all those things are telegraphed to the player, and each player experiences them, so they see the best content of that game. In this case, because it's made hidden for, like, as a design decision, I can see the case where a lot of people like me and don't see some of the best content in that game. So that's a positive and negative of the towers. I'm now going to move on to... I wanted that to be entirely positive, but there's two sides of that story. The sense of discovery is excellent. Just to finish that point, the sense of discovery is excellent. Again, I always go back to the time I first met the bard, who is my favorite character in that game. That is awesome. When you find out that the Garuda, whatever the name is, the people in the bottom left-hand corner, the female all-female tribe that doesn't let men into the city, when you find out about that, especially as a person like myself who's never played a Zelda before, that's interesting at least. Discovering areas of the map that are so different from one another is interesting. They do a good job there. So that sense of discovery is what Zelda does best. However, if you are like me and want deeper experiences, and that stuff is only in the quests, and the quests are hard to find, I think it misses a lot. So that's the positive negative there. Again, I can't make myself just be only positive about it. I'm sorry. All right. So moving on, combat in Zelda. So I will say that the strong negative about this, which I always felt, stays. I really don't like the combat in Zelda. It is surface level at best. The dodging mechanic is needless. The problem with it is you can brute force your way, as I did, through everything in that game. You can just eat food through any fight with no cooldowns. You can craft food that makes you so much more powerful than you are without the food. To the point where, like, I think the bonus is like 50%. If you have three of a symbol, so 50% bonus to attack, you have three swords, or 50% to defense, you have three defense, if you have three shields on the food you make. And that just means, especially combined with the fact that there's no cooldown on the healing items, you just do not need to get good in that combat. It's just fucking cakewalk through that. The second half of that game for me was just a cakewalk. I didn't even bother dodging. Like, the first half of the game, when you have barely any health and you're struggling through everything, and every other enemy is like killing you in one shot. That is too difficult, I feel. And then that's the very entry of the game. Then the second half of the game, where you have like 15 hearts and you can heal as much as you want to, and things only do like 5 hearts of damage to you, that's too easy. So like, it never really finds that balance, you know. I did a very strange thing for me, and then combined with the fact that the combat just feels so samey, like I assume there's multiple way like attack actions with many of the weapons, but I swear I just defaulted to the standing hit with the weapon, like just mash X or whatever the button was. Y, looking at the control now, I think it was Y. Just mash Y and you'll eventually kill them. That's pretty much it. Like, it doesn't matter what you're holding. I didn't even bother blocking through the second half of the game, except for the Ganon fight. I did not even use my shield through the second half of that game, because you don't need to. You either stun lock or knock down people with your two-handed weapons or one-handed weapons, and you just fucking mash to victory. If you hit you, you heal. Like, that's, there's nothing interesting about that fucking combat towards the end of that game. Sure, there's the dodging mechanic. Some of the mid-air stuff is kind of interesting that you can do, but that comes up so infrequently that just no. I can't get behind anyone who thinks the combat in that game is interesting. It has some level of depth. But if you compare it to anything that's like an actual third-person action game, like your Bayonettas or your Devil May Cries or anything like that, not even comparable. Not even like close to comparable. I don't even care about the fact that you use many different kinds of weapons that game. Like, probably my favorite combat in a while is either Dark Souls 3 or Bloodborne. And those games, even though you do only have like 2 buttons to attack with, by the way, twice as many buttons as you do have in Zelda, not including fucking the bow and arrow attack, which doesn't count. The fact that you only have 2 buttons to attack with, but there's so many different animations for every single weapon in that game. That's the gold standard that you need to hit, at least for a character action game. If you can't do a like absolute like stylish action like Devil May Cry, if you can't pull that off, at least hit Dark Souls level of depth. And if you can't do that, just go home. And that's kind of what this is. That's the negative side of Zelda. Positives again. I've talked about the sound design in Zelda in the past, and this I don't have anything negative to say about. Like, in Zelda excels in the sound department. I freaking love how that game sounds. The cutesy, you know, beeps and bops of like your UI isn't my style, but it never got grating, and that's good to say. That's like the sound of the world around you and how that factors into the gameplay, and it's so useful. Like that music when you're being when you're spotted by a guardian, or the beeping when you're at low health, even though it gets fucking annoying. Like, that's the point of that. The beeping when you have your Sheikah Slate tracking something, again, gets annoying. But that's the point of it. There's just in general, like, every piece of that sound design works to enhance the gameplay of the game, which is excellent. It also sounds clean and fantastic and spatial and just, yeah, it's great. Music is very good. I bet some people out there will fall in love with it. It is, but for me, it's like minimalist in a good way, but by being minimalist, like Uncharted 4, it's also a criticism in that it's just not there for a lot of the game, so it just doesn't feel very memorable. Even the main title theme wasn't particularly memorable, just like Uncharted 4 last year. So like that's like it's not really a negative, it's just like that's just a statement. They made that artistic choice with the sound design, and it isn't the wrong choice. It just with the music, it isn't the wrong choice, but it's, you know, it's just not necessarily my jam. But the sound design itself, though, it's top notch. I am not surprised that they built a whole spatial sound engine for the Switch, because that game sounds incredible. Back to negatives, though. This isn't gameplay, but I've been going for what, 33 minutes already, and I don't want to necessarily go for hours. Just general game related, the graphics of Zelda are, I want to say PS2 era, but that's just unfair. It's not true either. It looks like a Wii U game in, like, just through and through. Just through and through. It just looks like a Wii U game. That should be surprising because it is a Wii U game. But, like, it really does detract from this game for me. Like, art design goes a decent distance. But, like, at no moment while playing Zelda, except for the very end of the game, did I say, oh, sorry, and the reveal of the dungeons, where you get that sense of scale, do I have any sense of wonderment at the visuals of this game? The draw distance does have its benefits. Like, I really like the fact that you could see things for such a long distance, but I've talked about in the past about how monsters only get drawn in once you get closer. So that kind of invalidates a lot of it, because you can see something really cool in different distance and then see that there's, like, a lot of enemies to fight between here and there, and then go, fuck that, I don't feel like it, especially how bad the combat system is. So, like, it is really a detractor for me, just across the board. Some elements of it make me wish that they'd just gone cel-shaded for the whole thing. Like, fire looks incredible in Zelda. It's one of my favorite looking fire effects in any game ever. I love the way fire looks, and smoke. But at the same time, like, the rest of it, though, I guess you could call it cel-shaded, but it's not really. It's like a in-between realistic cel-shaded look. Just looks grimy. Like, rock looks terrible. Grass looks samey. Trees look the same. And low res and fucking aliased and shit. The costumes kind of, I think a lot of them look over designed and bad. Like, I really don't like the way the I don't know what you call it, guardian armor, ancient armor looks. It just kind of looks fucking shit. The probably the best armor in the game, in my opinion, the attack plus armor, the savage's armor or barbarian's armor, that looks terrible. Like, it just, so, like, art design isn't necessarily, like, a saving grace for the game either. Like, it doesn't necessarily have perfect art design. I like some of the cutesy stuff. Like, I love the little statues for the goddess. And I like the way that Link looks, even though he's weirdly short. I like the way all the races look, and they're distinct and they're somewhat unique. But at the same time, like, on the flip side, are there no female Gorons? Is there no living male, what's his face, Gerida, whatever the fucking name is? I think my favorite is probably the bird people. I forget their fucking name. I should remember this. I just beat this game on Sunday, but whatever. The bird people, because they look nice and very. They have, like, different colors and so on. For each of them, there's the male or female, and you have little children running around, all that kind of stuff, and they're all different colors, and so that's pretty adorable. But they do a thing with both them and the water people. Fuck, I've forgotten all these names, huh? The bird people and the water people, I feel sorry for you people who love Zelda. I don't actually hate them, whatever. In both cases, they have, like, one person in the whole tribe that looks totally different. It makes me just fucking regret that they put that person even in there, because it means they could have done so much more and they just chose not to. Like, in the Water People's tribe, there's a hammerhead dude, as opposed to, like, the normal shark-faced head dudes. And he looks so much cooler. And then it's like, wait, why is he the only fucking hammerhead dude? Why is there all kinds of fucking shark people? There should be a hammerhead dude. There should be, like, a different kind, like a nurse shark dude, like a fucking huge fat one. Like, unlike, well, I don't mean the king, but, you know, like, the rest of them should have people like that. There should be, like, different color patterns across all of them. Like, there's one hammerhead dude. That means they could have done so many different things with everyone else in the village, but they fucking didn't. Same with the bird people, where the chief is an owl dude. Where are the other owl dudes? Where'd the owl dude come from? Why is he the chief? It's like one of those things where there's only one owl dude born, and that he becomes chief, like the fucking male Gorons or whatever. Garudans, Garuda, yeah, fucking Garudas. Like, why is there only one owl dude? That means they could have done so many different things. Like, well, there's the parrot dude. The parrot dude's awesome. The bard. But Obis Severus, actually, is he even different? Is he just a different color than the other ones? Oh, no, he's got a different... So there's the bard dude, and then there's the owl dude, and everyone else just looks like an eagle dude. Where are the other dudes? Fuck that game. Like, God, I would love there for there to be more variety in the town. The towns also have, like, very small amounts of people, which I guess kind of makes sense, maybe? But it could have been interesting if you had more people in those towns, or the towns being bigger. Especially with the size of that world, and how it just is interesting. The world is gigantic, but the towns are tiny. I don't know. It's a positive and a negative here. It's a positive and a negative. But, like, yeah, just art design doesn't quite... What's there is generally great, but at the same time, it just doesn't quite go 110% like you'd want it to. Especially with the fucking scores this game has been getting. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Like, if you compare this to probably my high water marks, like, of recent years, Uncharted 4 and The Witcher, like, just how varied those games are in areas and fucking... And how good those games look. Like, this just doesn't compete. Fuck. I wonder how much this... Like, the massive buzz behind the look of this game is just the Zelda hype. Like, the people who grew up with Zelda and therefore anything... It's like me and Pokemon. Anything that happens in Pokemon is, like, a big deal to me. I guess that's just kind of the same thing with people in Zelda and Mario to some extent. Whatever. That's the look of that game. So let's see. We have the look of that game. We have the combat loop. We have the sound of the game. I need another positive before I get to the shrines and the Korok seeds. Oh, the dungeons. Without saying spoilers, because I don't want to get into spoiler talk right now, I really liked the look of the dungeons. I really like the way they're designed. I really like the way they work. I did find them easy across the board in an almost annoying level. The first dungeon, I hit an absolute wall. Like, I had no idea how to progress, so it was like I just fucking got stopped in my tracks. And I actually had to look it up. It turns out, well, all I really didn't know was the fact that you can use the map to manipulate the dungeon. And once I knew that, it just kind of all clicked into place, and then I solved that dungeon in like half an hour. So really it does kind of like beg a question as to where the good midpoint is for the puzzles in this game. And the same way, like, yeah, that's all I really have to say about dungeons, so I may as well move on to the shrines. Like, the shrines are all 40, 50 plus shrines I did are fucking too easy and boring. And I'm sorry, I know there's probably shrines out there that are amazing, but if a person plays a game with 120 shrines in it and plays 50 of them, 50 out of 120, and only find one, actually wait, four that were cool. I like the mazes and I like the island. Every single other one of them, so again, 50 plus is a play like 54, were just boring and easy. So the dungeons look amazing, are awesome. The fact that they work in puzzles into the game is great, in the fact that the shrines exist, but the shrines themselves are easy and boring. I'm sorry. I'm trying to be positive, but I just keep every positive in this game, I feel like a hit against a negative as well. I feel really sorry for people who love this game and stuck around. But yeah, like, just really every single thing about this game is awesome and crappy. Everything about this game has awesome element and a crappy element. Which brings me to like the storytelling. Awesome element. I like the characters, I guess I like the characters. Shitty element. They're all surface level and have no depth to them. Except for side quest characters, like the bard, who I didn't even know had a quest line, but apparently has an awesome quest line. And I read into it, and it does seem awesome. And he's got plenty of depth as a person. The main characters in this game... if you know nothing about Zelda, Breath of Breath of the Wild and probably stop. She's not here because I'm going to go from this into spoiler territory. Not right now, but I'm going to go to like mild spoilers now to major spoilers later. But like most of the main characters in this game are either locked away or dead because it's jumping between what happened 100 years ago and what's happening now. So you only get a couple of scenes with the main characters of this game. And that's only enough to get a taste for like what kind of person they are. And that would be fine if the ones in the present day who you can actually interact with were deep. But with those as well, you only get a couple of scenes with them. Each and every one of them. It is garbage tier. The quest lines for each town of the map, the main quest lines, only have like fucking four steps. At maximum. Some I can think of only have three. And that includes... go talk to this person, go to this place and fight a dude, get something, and come back. Those are your three steps. Those are your three steps to the fucking main, each quarter of the main quest line. And then you come back and do the dungeon. Like, that's kind of how that game is structured. It is kind of garbage tier. I like all the characters. That's the plus side. And some characters are amazing, like the bard. But there's other side. It's just look at it. It's like so surface level. Even MMO characters have... like deeper character development than this, and I'm not including WoW, where obviously those characters have been around for so many years that they are incredibly deep, even though it's written by Blizzard and Blizzard isn't fucking famous for that deep shit. But like, wow, it's just weird how the structure of the characters in this game work and the story. So apparently, and this I didn't know until playing this, the method for Nintendo making Zelda games has been one track, in that they focus on gameplay first and foremost, and they decide on the gameplay elements of game and then make the story to fit the gameplay. And for movies, for me, the equivalent movies to that would be things like John Wick, which I love and is all about making the fight scenes awesome and then crafting a movie to fit the fight scenes. But in that case, those fight scenes are top tier. They are the best fight scenes, I think, or action scenes of any movie in the last many years. Maybe even of all time. There's a 10-minute fight in the middle of John Wick 2. And that is freaking incredible. I loved every moment of it. But this, where the combat system, as I said earlier, isn't that great. And maybe the open world design is like some people's, well, it looks like most people's cup of tea, looking at the Metacritic score. But that just doesn't account for... what they had to do to the storyline to fit for that. And so essentially what they said was, because of the open world structure and the fact that you can approach the story from any angle, any order of events, they couldn't figure out a way to make the story complete and large scale and pervasive. They had to make it into like a lot of small things you pick up in any order you want. Now, I think that is an excuse that would only be acceptable from an indie developer. I can't accept that from a major first-party studio. Because fans have come up with ways that would work perfectly fine in terms of crafting a storyline. Because... the major element this game is missing, aside from the story being contiguous, which is to some degree fine if it's not contiguous, but this game is missing a really good villain. Because Ganon is in the tower, the castle the whole game. You only see him, spoilers, at the end of the game, surprise. So there is no real villain in this game. There's no one to dislike, and there's no one to like get worked up about and to create drama. The closest to it, and I'll get to that in spoilers, is in the the desert people place. I was gonna call them the desert people. All right, that's just how this is gonna go. And they have this awesome assassins guild that you interact with, and I'll talk about more in the spoiler section. But that's the closest you get to an interesting opposing force to be there. Aside from that, you have these respawning enemies that come back every red moon, and disinteresting fucking shrines, which are easy, and you have your dungeons. Fuck, guys. If they, for example, taken a step back and went, okay, we can at least build up the quests before getting to each dungeon and work in there as a way to get more story in this game, that would have been perfectly fine. Maybe making the last part of getting through Hyrule Castle at the very end of the game, and I'm not going to talk about spoilers, maybe making that more deep and have story elements to it, of which it has very minimal. Maybe that would put a little bit more story in there. Definitely the parts that would be along the main quest line could have had more story. But beyond that, fucking, there's only 18 or like 19 memories in this game. There's like 19 cutscenes. What? And most of them are like 30 seconds to like a minute and a half long. That's the story in this game. Like, what is that? That's the intro of a Final Fantasy game. Final Fantasy XV is an open world Final Fantasy game, and that has a pretty great story. The storytelling is terrible. The voice acting is questionable. But the story itself, the actual story, if you read it as a book, is actually kind of awesome. And this, by comparison, just feels like, I don't know, it feels like episode one of a hero's journey and then kind of ends. Easy Allies did a fantastic podcast about storytelling in the recent Zelda game. It's hosted by Damiani, who's their Zelda expert, and he's like actually really, really has deep knowledge about Zelda. And they have a number of criticisms, even them who love the game far more than I do. Like they all think it's like a 10 out of 10 game, except for Bradley Ellis. And even they have many of the same problems I do. Like, Link has no character development in this game. To be fair, he is a cipher for you, but this game is about Zelda, not Link, which I guess is great because the game's called The Legend of Zelda, but Link is just a cipher who just goes around beating things up. Only deal. Aside from the side quest characters, like, none of the main people have any form of like further depth. And as I said before, there's no villain. And if you just add all those things together with the fact that there's only like 18 fucking 30 second to 1 minute long cutscenes in this whole fucking game, of which all of which are optional, except for like, actually no, every single one of them are optional, except for one, I think, which is the one before you leave the starting area. That's just fucking sad. That's just sad. That's just what the hell. And beyond that, not only are they optional, they're hard to find. Like, if you don't use a guide, like at the end, I just resorted to using a guide for the ones I didn't find. If you don't use a guide to find the memories, you might get through that game easily without finding like most of the memories in that game. And that's the core story. And it's not like the memory, like, oh, right next to somewhere you'd obviously go. They're kind of in the middle of nowhere for a lot of them. And I guess it's trying to double down the sense of exploration. But say you, for example, for me, for one case, searched around the world for an hour and a half to find a 1 minute long cutscene, which didn't even feel contiguous with the other stuff because there's no order to them. Like, you have to do them in, they're not even in order form when you look at them when you first get the pointers to how to find the cutscenes, these images you get. They're not even in order. So, like, when I did the first one, that was just, it just meant nothing to me. And oh God, like, the story in this game. But that said, if you do move on to spoiler territory, I can say why I do like this game a lot. And a lot of it is spoilery stuff. So there you go. That is the end of my non-spoiler section to Zelda. I don't know how long I'm going to talk spoiler-wise, but if you don't want to literally the end of the game, etc., being spoiled, tune out now and thank you for listening to this Cynical Supplement. We probably won't record this weekend because I'm out of town. I don't know if the other guys have their have things together to like really get something recorded, but you can probably see us in a week's time. We'll probably have an episode then. So thank you for listening to this Cynical Supplement, and see you next episode of maybe a Cynical Supplement, maybe a Scotchcast. But now we'll move on to Zelda spoilers. And this is kind of what turned me around in the game. Essentially, how I beat the game was I did all the things I said before, like all the shrines to get enough hearts to get the Master Sword, and you need 13, and then enough to get 2 stamina bars, circles, and then did all like the dungeons and stuff. And then just before I finished the game, I went through and, using a guide for stuff I hadn't found yet, found every single memory and then fought the final dungeon. So essentially my final memories of the game are all story stuff, which is, I guess, kind of cheating in some ways, because story isn't supposed to be the strength of this game. But if you do it that way, where you like don't do any story stuff and at the very end just do it all in the lump and then finish the game, it actually kind of feels excellent. Like, it felt good. Like, you had a continuous story from start to finish, and you get all elements of it. So the story of Zelda is the story of this game. It is pretty much all 100 years ago and told in recount, and you have to find all the memories. But if you do find all the memories, you can then watch them in order on your list. And that really just gives you just a nice little tale of a woman who just fucking... She reminds me of Yuna from Final Fantasy X. It's a person who gives their all and just gets knocked down, just can't make it, just can't quite get there. Just always letting people down, or feels like she's letting people down, just like putting every bit of her heart and soul into completing this task and just can't get there. And then everything falls apart on her at the very end. And just as it seems like everything is lost and all is for naught, it turns around. And that's an awesome story. That's an awesome story to see in one contiguous like lump. So like those memories towards the end of playing A Breath of the Wild, combined with the music, combined with the culmination of all the effort I put in like getting the Master Sword and beating all the dungeons and getting enough like 2 stamina bars and all the powers from all the guardians, so I can quickly ascend the tower, the castle. Like, you put all that together, it just felt so fulfilling at the end of that game. So like the core story, like I've already talked about my misgivings about how it's told and the lack of depth of the characters, but in the end, the characters are likable. Like, I liked all the modern guys, especially the water dude. The shark dude, I liked him a bunch. I like your interactions with all the older, like the people in the past. Like, that was nice. Like, you got a good feeling for who all those people are. Could the game have gone to more depth? Absolutely. But if you do it all one stint like I did, it's fine, I guess. And that really got me to turn around, at least on the emotional core of this game. Because I think like the gameplay has, as I said before, massive highs and massive lows. But it's really like the emotion behind this game that can really decide whether you fall in love with it or not. If you get into the side quests, many of which I missed, in fact, most of which I missed, how you can get that earlier. Like, if you do the Bard side quests, I can see how that would make you just really love that part of this game deeply. If you like, there's actually a couple of characters, I don't want to necessarily like ruin them all, but there's a couple of characters where you like really do spend time with them after a while, and you get to know, like, to be fair, like, it's not like you have like fucking persona levels of interaction with these people, but you do get like a consistent thread with a lot of these people that can give it like an emotional heart. But considering I didn't do that, what I did get was this one emotional heart with Zelda herself and her journey. And that was awesome. The storyline being that she is told from a young age that she has the power to channel the goddess and the sealing force to seal away Ganon. And so her whole life has been dedicated to try and discover how to use it. And her mother dies when she's young. And her father is king, so he has so much pressure on him that he conveys that pressure to her. And so she is essentially this beating against this wall of never being able to discover how her power is used, but knowing that it's, and it's prophesized that she's the one who have to, who has the power to seal away Ganon. And so just as she turns 17, she goes to the last of three shrines for the goddess. And on that day, not only can she still, after going to the final shrine that she hadn't visited because there's an age restriction on it, and you had to go there once you turn of age, on that last day, just as when she goes to that shrine and then discovers she still can't find out her powers, the world comes to an end. Ganon takes over all the guardians and just wipes everyone out and almost destroys everything. Kills all, like, essentially your character's best friends. Some of them they were raised with. The champions of the Zora. That's the fucking bird people. The Zora and everyone else. Now I've remembered their name. I've forgotten fucking everyone else's. The Zora bird people or the water people? The water people. Whatever. All your best friends are dead suddenly. And your kingdom's falling apart and Ganon's back and you still don't know how you discover power. So how to use your power. That's a really heart-wrenching moment for Zelda. And I guess that like transitions to me be able to talk about the voice acting in this game. Zelda's voice acting is fucking terrible. She is like total trash. Like, I don't know how Nintendo let that be the localization for this game. And on top of that, Link pisses me the fuck off, because it's one thing to have a silent protagonist. It's another thing to have a silent protagonist that clearly like spends time explaining large and lengthy like bits of information to other people, but all you get is an animation and no sound whatsoever. That's not the right way to do a silent protagonist. I'm sorry. That's just fucked up. That's just you being shit at trying, like, you just be having cold feet about finally giving Link a voice. It is not actually difficult to find a cool voice that people get behind. Anime has done it for many years. Other video games have done it for many years. They found cool main character voices that I bet would not piss many people off. Because Link isn't an actual silent protagonist in this game. He just doesn't have a voice actor. He talks to people. You just don't hear it. He has dialogue choices. You just don't hear it. It's garbage. That combined with Zelda's terrible fucking voice acting and the fact that multiple scenes have people ask questions of Link and he just stands there saying fucking nothing is ludicrous. But if you set those things aside, the core emotional heart of this game is cool. And I like that a whole bunch. So if you combine that with the satisfaction of having all your efforts come to a close in the climactic elements of the game, where you finally come up against Ganon. Actually, I'll rewind a bit. Let's just talk from my final element. Sorry, I paused there because I'm trying to get my thoughts together. I've been rambling on. To close off my thoughts about the memories. 17th memory, or the final memory, that's an interesting thing. You have this whole journey with Zelda and trying to find out how everything happened, or how everything came to have passed as it finally did. How she finally was able to at least stall Ganon, and so she must have discovered her powers. That all comes to the final memory you get, the 17th memory, which is after the world essentially ended and everyone's been defeated and you have almost lost all hope. Actually, you have all lost all hope. You think you've lost. Link is mortally wounded and Zelda is able to discover her powers to protect him. And that's cool. That is a cool moment to watch come to pass. All the memories back to back to back. Seeing that moment was moving. Finding out that she's the one who arranged, well, you know this, but like just seeing how she did it. And the fact that she was alone in doing so, except for like some Anbu Black Ops equivalent, like ninja dudes who like transport Link's body. But like the fact that she arranges for Link to be put in the resurrection chamber, the fact that she goes and seals away the Master Sword to Ganon and fucking holds him off for 100 years. Like, Zelda is a hero in this game. That's pretty awesome. And seeing that come together is really fun. So with that, like having just done that, Because the first time I went to the castle, I just got the Zelda, the 16th memory, which is Zelda's study, and then got out of there. So I didn't really like, it didn't count. The first time I went to the castle, it didn't count. Going to the castle, the way I approached it felt like a culmination of everything. And the fight with Ganon. So I went to the castle, went to the basement, got the Hyrule shield, because that was fun. Then went back up and went back to the entrance. And I essentially felt like I was starting the castle from scratch. And the powers that the other guardians or the champions give you all came into effect in my ascent of that tower. And that's what really felt great. Because I, having played, 40-something hours of Zelda, was kind of over it by that point. But I'm just, after having just seen a bunch of the story, wanted to see its conclusion, and I was just kind of rushing through it. You can get to the top of the tower in like 3 minutes. And that felt awesome. Essentially, you just use the massive jump glide ability that the bird people give you to armor that lets you climb up waterfalls that the water people give you. You just use that to just massively, rapidly ascend the tower. You can walk through the front gate. There's a waterfall to your left, and then there's like two high jumps after that, you're at the peak of the tower of the castle, and that just felt awesome. But not only that, so like, yeah, you get to the peak really quickly, but along the way there are diary entries, so you can see Zelda's perspective on different elements of the story, and that's great. And apparently there's King's diary entries as well, which I missed. I will not go back for them, but I heard those are cool too. But you can essentially, after two jumps, I had to wait for a bit because it started raining, and I was able to like explore around and like get these diary entries and read them. That was fun. I haven't gone into how much I hate rain, and I won't. Rain is terrible. Rain is the worst thing about this game. It makes this actively lose a point in my eyes. But moving on, the final jump to get to the throne room felt awesome. And then you have the boss fight with Ganon. So, rewinding back, I will continue to reiterate that one of the fundamental problems with this game is that there's no villain that you can really get behind. And Ganon continues that, where what you find out is that he's just in this blob, and he's just this mindless rage beast. And that's just sad. That's just not an interesting villain. Like, I would have loved if it was like Ganon was this dude that you finally meet at the end of the game, and maybe you go through like one like surprise dungeon at the very end of the game. That could have been cool, and like you're talking with him, or you like have a rep between him the whole time. But you know, he just like comes out of this fucking blob in the ceiling, and you just fight him. That said, though, when you finally start the fight and all of the divine beasts fire at him at the same time and knock off half his health in one foul swoop, that felt really cool. I really like watching that happen. I'm also kind of surprised there was only half his health. Like, considering you're just hitting him with a sword, it feels kind of off that four massive death beams from gigantic divine beasts can only take off half his health. I don't know. Just didn't feel consistent. But whatever. That felt really great. Just seeing them all fire at him and take off half his health. That felt really cool. That culmination there. But the greatest thing for me in this whole game was that in the final fight, every power was useful in a really cool way. So I didn't realize that you can reflect. So this fight is essentially two stages, or three stages, if you count the transformation at the very end, which we'll get to later. But the first two stages is he's just on the ground. He just felt like a Dark Souls boss. Like, that actually did feel pretty much like a Dark Souls boss. I was just dodging, blocking with my Hyrule shield, which pretty much just negates almost all of his damage, and hitting with my sword. And that was pretty much it. If it's dodging around him and hitting with my sword. It was a nice, basic Dark Souls boss, and that felt like the only good boss fight I had in this game. Aside from the desert people, which I'll probably talk about later. If I can remember. And that was fine. And then he goes on the wall, and it's kind of a puzzle boss. So it's like kind of the other puzzle boss element of Zelda kind of being exploited here. That was kind of interesting. And I didn't realize that you can reflect his blasts at him to knock him to the ground. But what I did find out was that if you do the hold Y lightning flash thing that the desert woman gives you, that champion power, he gets knocked down and you can hit him a bunch. So, like, just straight up, you have this boss fight where I'm using a power, like the rock people's power to block attacks, and then followed by the lightning power from the sand people. Like, those two or four, I was like, oh, cool. I'm actually using these powers to take down Ganon. That's really awesome. So I finally knock him down a bunch of times and take him out. And then you run out of, sorry, I knock him down a bunch of times and then you run out of power. Like, you run out of the lightning thing. And what I end up using was, you can still do it anywhere on the map if you just use the Master Sword itself, like its own knockdown ability. In fact, that's probably what I was doing the first few times, but it felt like it was the lightning power that was doing it. So the Master Sword can also knock him down if you hold down your Y long enough and charge it up. You'll knock him down one hit and then you can beat the shit out of him. So I've used the Goron power, I've used the Garuda power, and I've used the Master Sword's power already, and that felt really awesome as a culmination. And that's after all the Divine Beasts attacked this final boss. So I bring him down to zero health, and you get a cutscene, and you're suddenly taken out to the world at large, and you fight Ganon in like pig form, like a massive purple flame covered beast Ganon, which is awesome. And you're on a fucking horse, and that's so cool. So I love it because it's such a departure from almost any boss I've ever had before. Where, and to be fair, I haven't played Shadow of the Colossus, but being in an open field and fighting a boss at the same time, riding around a horse while doing so, actually the only other time I've ever felt this was Darksiders, because they have a similar thing happen there. But I just love the feeling because it brought together that this whole time you've been fighting for the world, you've been fighting for Hyrule, and doing the last leg of the fight in the plains of Hyrule felt so amazing to me. So you're riding around Beast Ganon, and Zelda gives you this amazing like bow, this fancy bow. So you're doing like cool riding, bowman archery shit, and it feels like a victory lap. But as you get Ganon to the last bit of his health, it becomes a puzzle boss again. And this is where the last two powers come in. Because what it turns out you have to do is you have to go to Ganon's head, giant pig beast Ganon with flames all over him, his head. Whenever he uses his powers, his forehead opens up and these giant eyes come out. And that's apparently like the soul of Ganon that you can attack. But to actually hit them, you're supposed to use the updraft from his laser beam attack. He's this giant beam that instant kills you. And I didn't know it instant killed you. I didn't know how to block it. So it tells, like, Zelda tells you, oh, you have to use the updraft to shoot at his eye using the slow motion stuff from your bow. So what happens is I'm standing there waiting for the beam attack. I take out my shield. It does not block it for shit. I get fucking annihilated. Max health plus like 10 hearts. So I was like to like 25 hearts or something. Or at least I think I did. That's my memory of the event. Maybe it wasn't. To nothing. I was instantly killed. But at that point, the Zora fucking power breaks off. So the water girl comes down and brings me back to life. And then I realized that, wait, I don't need the updraft. Or I can use the wind power to get into the sky. So the culmination of this fight, I'd used the blocking power from the stone people. I'd used the lightning power from the sand people. I'd just been revived at the very last moment, at the very end of the fight, by the water people. And to finish it all off, I soar into the sky using the air people's power. I'm sorry for you not using the race's name, but it still felt amazing. And then did that slow-mo fucking sweet-ass bow shot into Ganon's head. And that was the end of the game for me. It felt goddamn incredible. That was awesome. That fucking fight was made the whole game for me. And that's why I went from like a 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10 to like a straight up 8 out of 10 for Zelda. I just like that culmination of the story and the characters and divine beasts and all that stuff coming together with that final fight at the end, ascending that tower, using all the powers, and then just that one slow-mo finishing kill shot in the sky using the last of the Guardian's power I hadn't used yet. That was awesome. That was great. The So I guess from there, we'll just go into the final moments of that game. And then I'll talk to, like, I'll just do a victory lap by talking about some of the dungeons. I really liked the last moments. I really liked the last kind of cutscenes with you and Zelda. Finally meeting after 100 years. This character that you'd only seen through flashbacks, finally meeting her with your character, with Link. And the way they interact with each other just feels so, I don't know, to be fair, it's PG-13 nonsense, but, like, you know, it still feels heartfelt and nice. The fact that, like, you have these kind of last moments of Zelda and Link just looking up at the decimated Hyrule Castle and noting that they need to start again, and then walking away, like, leaving Hyrule Castle behind, noting that it's in the past for them and they need to rebuild. That was just a nice, poignant moment. And just as they turn away, the ghosts come back. And again, after all I'd just done, that was felt really poignant to me, that the ghosts come back and are just like floating above Hyrule Castle and watch over you and then disappear. That was wonderful. So you have that great moment. And then forgetting the 17 memories, optional memories, and I think the total is like 19 memories or whatever, you get a bonus scene after the end statement. And it's just Zelda and Link. It feels like a couple of weeks later, maybe like a month or so later or something, talking about how they are roaming the world now, fixing things for people and trying to get everything back to working. And they just have a nice, like, character moment of them just discussing, like they used to, like, what, where they're going to travel next and what they're going to do together. And you have Zelda telling Link, and I looked at why this is important, that she can't hear the voice of the Master Sword anymore. And apparently what that means, and this meant a lot to me at the time after I found out, is that for this version of Zelda and Link, their adventures with Ganon are over. And that's awesome. And what that means is that they will have a nice, happy, fulfilling life together. Assuming everything doesn't go to shit for them as a couple. But, like, they will have us a nice, happy life together. And it's essentially a happily ever after moment when she says, I can't hear the sword anymore. And that's actually really great. I really liked how that's how they communicated that. That's like a nice fan moment that you have to, like, kind of understand what she's saying to even get what that means. I like that. Even though I had to look it up, it's a good thing to do for your fans at the end of that game, especially since you have to get every memory to see that scene. That was awesome. So that's the main of Zelda, and that's the spoilery segment. And I will do a couple of spoilers here about the dungeons. If I was to rank dungeons, I would say that they all wowed me when I first saw them. But none of them were particularly interesting. The one that made me the most, like, feel the most was the one I did last, actually, the Goron, the people's dungeon, where the first fifth of that dungeon, you actually are walking around in total darkness, and it's all about spreading light. That was incredible to me. The fact that I'd done three dungeons before and they can still come up with something that surprised me was fantastic. I felt so good when the lights shut off and I was like, oh shit, I did not expect that in this dungeon. That was great. I like the mechanical nature of all dungeons, the fact that you can control the beasts and, like, move stuff around. Gliding from the tip of one wing of the aerial dungeon all the way down to the tip of the other by tilting the rings correctly. That was kind of cool. I wish that those mechanics were more meaningful in the boss fights at the end of the dungeons. And honestly, like, the thing I remember most from each dungeon is actually just the story moments with the champions for each of them, especially the water dungeon where you find out how she loved you the whole time, all that kind of stuff. That was just, like, wonderful and nice. Like, that was the first dungeon I did. That was just really cool. But, like, just the grandeur of each dungeon was awesome. But also led to some of the most frustrating parts of the game for me, where Like, I did kind of wish I could climb a new surface in Dungeon. I hated how they broke that design constraint. So they put on this the design constraint when there isn't anywhere else. Like, you can climb up the entirety of Hyrule Castle that you can't climb up these dungeons. Like, it just didn't feel right, especially since the surface textures didn't like indicate to me that they'd be impossible to climb. Like, I can kind of give you like solid metal, like that makes sense to me, like why you can't climb that, but this just looks like rock. So it was just doubly bullshit that you can't climb all over the inside of those dungeons. And mostly, like, the puzzles are just surface level boring. Like, once you find out that you can manipulate the dungeons by looking at the map, you can like immediately figure out how to do every single fucking puzzle in that dungeon within seconds of looking at it. Just like the shrines, which I fucking hate, just because they're so easy. But yeah, just the grandioseness of the dungeons were awesome, and the story moments with each character were fantastic. Like, how the Goron guy finally see and wave to his grandson at the end was awesome. I assume it's his grandson. Finding out about the love between the fish girl and you. Just the friendly rivalry, or not so friendly rivalry, between you and the aerial dude. He's the flying dude. That was cool. And it's like, I liked everything about the sand people. Pretty much everything was freaking cool. I loved the quest to get to the dungeon. That was the only good one. I appreciated the Lionel fight for the water people, in that it was an interesting thing that it got me to do, especially because at the time I was way too underpowered to fight a Lionel. So it was like a fun thing where I actually had to be stealthy and I actually had to like utilize my my gray matter to figure out how to get these arrows without alerting this Lionel. If I alerted Lionel, how to fucking get away from him, but not get too far, because I didn't want to climb up the mountain again. That was cool, but the whole stealth sequence with the assassins people, or like just like getting to the room and not figuring out, like not being able to see how to get to their lair, and then realizing, oh wait, there's torches everywhere, I probably have to light these giant banners on fire. Like that was like one of the few times you manipulate cloth in that game to create a result, and that was like a cool little puzzle that they put in there. Then you get into stealth sequence, and at the point it was at the end of the game for me, that was like the second last dungeon I'd done. I had like 15 hearts, I had the master sword, like I was able to wreck face through that dungeon, so I didn't do stealth at all. I just fought everything, and that was fun because the enemies there are difficult enough that it actually felt like the game was finally scaling with me difficulty wise. So fighting through that stealth sequence was actually fun, and I like that. But then it gets to my second favorite boss fight in the game, which is so number one would be Beast Ganon, number two would probably be, just because of the spectacle, so I guess this is number three. Number two would be actual Ganon, Calamity Ganon, which is, he's just a cool Dark Souls fight. It's the standard Dark Souls fight, like equivalent to like the first boss of any Dark Souls game, in difficulty, and that felt nice after how easy the rest of the game was, except for Lionel's. And then third would be this, where it was like a nice, this felt like a Zelda boss fight. This felt like the first boss fight that's pretty much just purely a puzzle the whole way through, but also semi to do with how much DPS you have. Like, it just felt like a great balance of like quirkiness and puzzle and actual boss fight where you get to dodge around and stuff. It just felt fantastic. Like, I really liked the fight with the head of the Assassin's Guild. I forgot the name. And that was just really cool. Like, that whole sequence with like meeting, like trying to find out how to get into the Garuda domain, having to dress up, like cross dress to get in there, meeting the underaged queen, helping her out, doing the Assassin's Guild stuff, one of the best boss fights in the game. That sequence was fantastic. Could have been deeper? Absolutely. I was 100% expecting each of these quests to be like four times as long. This felt like a middling side quest from The Witcher, but in the context of Zelda Breath of the Wild, it was fantastic. And the boss fight was a Zelda boss fight, unlike anything from The Witcher. So that boss fight was probably better than most things from The Witcher. Just because I just like how, yeah, the quirkiness and everything else just blended together. That was fantastic. But no, that's pretty much the devil in a nutshell. Like, they all kind of have their own flavor. That none of them are particularly difficult. But the story moments from each can really, really got me in some cases. That was nice. Yeah, that was nice. So that's Zelda, man. A lot of the way I feel about that game is because of the way I finished it and the way I built up towards finishing it. But hey, like, each, I think that's the strength of this game. Every person who plays this game has a different experience with it. And that's a lot to say in its favor. And again, why I'm leaning towards an 8 out of 10 rather than like a 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, which is kind of what I was leaning towards before. It just has a lot of, some of this game has a lot of heart in a really fantastic way. It has a lot of amazing design decisions, but also conversely, a lot of ones that really piss me off, like the lack of Link speaking, even though he fucking story. The storytelling just fucking isn't great, but the heart of the story is fine. So like, yeah, this is highs and lows, highs and lows, highs and lows throughout. But overall, like, it's a good game. Like, it is undeniably a very good game. I am happy this is my first Zelda. It did not convince me to go back and play additional Zeldas. Especially knowing that this is different to all the others. I've heard that, what's his face? The really cel shady one. Not fucking Link to the Past. Wind Waker. I heard Wind Waker and the Game Boy games or something have like a contiguous story that runs through all of them. That could be interesting. Like, maybe I'd do that in the future. But considering I have like fucking Nier to play, and I'm about to play some 3 because Necromancer's out, that's awesome. I'm up for that to be a thing. But yeah. Zelda. Holy cow. I don't ever go back to play them because I have other stuff to play, as I just said, but it's a good game. That's a good game. And that's all I have to say of Zelda. That's all I have to say for this week. So thank you for listening to this episode of the Skin Cynical Supplement and my Zelda ruminations. I hope I didn't make you too angry, especially since I can't fucking remember the name of the races. You know what? Just for people at home, I'm going to look them up now. Zelda races. Let's see. What am I missing here? The top 10 Legend of Zelda races. Wow, this is not what I was expecting. So Hylian's obviously the thing. The Sheikah, which are the people of the past. The Gerudo. I was calling the Garuda, but the Gerudo are the sand people. They're pretty cool. The Zora and Rito. I think it's the Zora in this game. What are they, Rito? Might be Rito. The Zora are the fish people, right? This article is terrible. It's not being very clear as to what the fuck is what. Zora. I'm just going to look up Zora. 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 Zora Zelda. Yep. So the Zora are the fish people. And the Rito, I guess, are the bird people. Yep. And then you have the Gorons. So those are... That's just for people here. I looked them up. There you go. Gorons. I liked the Zora the most. I like how gigantic and hilariously gigantic the king is. The champion was just awesome. I really like that side plot with the fact that she loved you and all that kind of stuff, and how she crafted you that armor and how that helps you in the end. I like the prince that you meet in the modern day. Like, I just like everything about that. But in terms of quest lines, the Gerudo. Fucking God, I've already lost it. That was the best by far with the Assassin's Guild mode. Fuck. How do I fucking. Gerudo. Yeah, Gerudo. Sorry. Alright, I'm just gonna close this off. I'm gonna close this off and quit while I'm ahead. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Single Supplement. And goodbye.